Mein Kampf, Volume 1, Chapter 7, The Revolution. Enemy propaganda first came to us in 1915. From 1916 on, it became more and more intensive and swelled until the beginning of 1918, when it grew into an absolute flood. The effects of dangling the bait were seen at every step. The army gradually learned to think the way the enemy wanted it to. The German counter-efforts were a complete failure. The so-called leader who guided the army had those around him who possessed the drive and desire to take up the struggle of counter-propaganda, but the necessary tools were not there, and they had no means to distribute anything even if they had produced it. It would have been a mistake, psychologically, for the army to give this enlightenment to the troops. If it was to be effective, it had to come from home. Otherwise, it was impossible to count on it being successful among men who had suffered starvation and whose immoral deeds of heroism and endurance had been performed for that very homeland for nearly 4 years. But what did come from home? Was the failure a result of stupidity or evil? In midsummer of 1918, after the retreat from the southern bank of the Marne, a river in northern France, the German press started to demonstrate not only incompetence, but criminal stupidity. I asked myself with daily and increasing disappointment if no one at home was going to put an end to this intellectual sabotage of the army's heroism. What happened in France when we swept into the country in 1914 in an unparalleled whirlwind of victory after victory? What did Italy do while her Isonzo front along the Isonzo River in eastern Italy was collapsing? What did France do in spring of 1918 when the assaults of the German divisions seemed to be unhinging the French positions and the long-reaching arm of the German heavy artillery was pounding on the gates of Paris? They raised the boiling point of national passion and stoked the fire of weakening courage and hurled it in the faces of the retreating regiments. How wonderfully their propaganda skills inspired and influenced the masses as they labored to pound into the hearts of the broken front soldiers a belief in the final victory, now more than ever. And what was happening on our side? Nothing. I was often overcome with outrage and fury when I received the latest newspapers and saw the psychological mass murder they were committing. More than once, I was tortured by the thought that if Providence had put me in place of these criminal incompetents and do-nothings in our propaganda service, the war would have ended in a different fashion. During those months, for the first time, I felt the full force of cruel fate, who was holding me at the front in a spot where any Negro could, by chance, point his rifle in the wrong direction and shoot me down. While if I had been in another place, I could have performed a very different service for the fatherland. Even then, I was presumptuous enough to believe I would have succeeded. But I was a nameless one among 8 million, so it was better to stay quiet and do my duty as well as possible where I was. In the summer of 1916, my first enemy leaflets fell into our hands. With only minor variations, their substance was almost invariably the same. The distress in Germany was growing ever grateful. The war would last forever, while the chance of winning it was vanishing. People at home were longing for peace, but militarism and the Kaiser would not consider peaceful solutions. The whole world was making war on the one guilty foe called the Kaiser and not on the German people. The struggle would not come to an end until this enemy of peaceable mankind was eliminated. After the war ended, the peacefulness and democratic nations would receive the German people into the League of Eternal World Peace, a peace that was guaranteed to spring forth from the moment Prussian militarism was destroyed. And it was good. To illustrate these claims, they included letters from home, which appeared to confirm these statements. At the time, everybody just laughed at these attempts. The leaflets were read and then sent to the rear for the commanders to inspect. Then they were forgotten until the wind blew another load down onto the trenches. They even sent special airplanes just to drop the leaflets. There was one striking element in this kind of propaganda. In every sector where there were Bavarians, an attack on Prussia was pushed with extraordinary persistence. It said that Prussia was solely responsible for the war, and there was not the slightest hostility against Bavaria, but they could not come to the assistance of Bavaria as long as it seemed Prussian interests and or as long as it served Prussian interests and kept pulling Prussia's chestnuts out of the fire. This technique actually began to have a certain effect as early as 1915. Bad feelings against Prussia noticeably increased among the troops without producing the slightest countermeasures from our leadership. This was more than a mere sin of omission. Sooner or later, there were bound to be serious repercussions, and not for the Prussians, but for the German people, of which Bavaria is a considerable part. Enemy propaganda began to have definite success in this area by 1916. The real letters from home were filled with complaints, which had also started to take effect. It was no longer necessary for the enemy to drop leaflets into our trenches. The letters were delivered by post. The government in charge did nothing except issue a few foolish warnings while the front was constantly flooded with this poison sent from home by thoughtless women. They never dreamed that this would strengthen the enemy's confidence and increase the sufferings of their loved ones at the front lines. The silly letters from German women eventually cost hundreds of thousands of men their lives. Even by 1916, several alarming signs became apparent. The men at the front were cursing and complaining. They were discontented and justifiably resentful in many respects. While they were starving and suffering and their families at home were in misery, they could still see places where there was abundance and festive living. Even at the front itself, everything wasn't as it should have been in this respect. There were faint warnings of crisis, but these were still internal, were all still internal matters. The man who growled and cursed would silently do his duty a few minutes later, as if it were habit. The same company that was feeling discontented would dig into the section of trenches it had to defend, as if Germany's fate depended upon this 100 yards of mud and shell holes. This front line was still formed by the old, magnificent Army of Heroes. It would soon experience the difference between it and home in glaring contrast. At the end of September 1916, my division entered the Battle of the Somme, one of the largest battles in the First World War, with over 1.5 million casualties at the River Somme in northern France. For us, it was the first of the huge battles that now followed, and the impression it created is hard to describe. It seemed more like hell than a war. The German front held out against the whirlwind drumming of the guns for weeks at a time. Sometimes they were pushed back, then they would advance, but they never gave up. On October 17, 1916, I was wounded. I arrived safely at the rear and was ordered to Germany by transport vehicle. 2 years had passed since I had seen home, which was an almost endless stretch of time to be away. I couldn't even imagine how Germans who were not in uniform would look. When I was in the base hospital at Hermes, a farming village in France at the time, I was startled when the voice of a German woman, a nurse, addressed a man lying next to me. It was wonderful hearing a sound like that for the first time in 2 years. The nearer to the border the train approached, which was bringing us home, the more restless each man became. All the towns moved past that we had ridden through 2 years before as young soldiers, Brussels, Louvain, Liège. Finally, we thought we recognized the first German house by its high gables and striking shutters. It was the Fatherland! On October 1914, we had been on fire with wild enthusiasm when we crossed the border. Now, stillness and reverence ruled. We were all happy that fate had allowed us to once again see what we were defending so fiercely with our lives. Almost on the anniversary of my departure, I arrived at the hospital in the Brandenburg town of Bielitz, near Berlin. What a change! From the mud of the Battle of the Somme into the white beds of this amazing structure. At first, one hardly dared lie in them. Unfortunately, this world was new in other ways, too. The spirit of the frontline army wasn't here. For the first time, I heard something we didn't know about at the front. Someone boasting of his own cowardice. One did indeed hear cursing and grumbling at the front, but never to encourage the neglect of or the dereliction of duty, let alone to glorify the coward. No, the coward was still a coward, and nothing more. On the front, he was treated with contempt as strong as the admiration that was felt for a true hero. But here in the hospital, conditions were almost the reverse. The most dishonest troublemakers and unprincipled trouble seekers took the floor and tried in every way, with every resource of their sorry eloquence, to make the decent soldier appear ridiculous and the coward's lack of character a model to be emulated. A few disgraceful fellows were the ringleaders. One said that he had struck his own hand into the barbed wire entanglement, so he would be sent to the hospital. Despite the minor nature of his injury, he appeared to have been here for a very long time, and was planning to stay. It appeared that an arrangement was struck as the result of a swindle or bribe which allowed him to stay here, and another such act was the only reason he made it on a transit train for Germany at all. This filthy pest of a fellow actually had the nerve to display his own cowardice shamelessly and claim it was the result of a bravery higher than the heroic death of an honorary soldier. Many listened in silence. Others walked away. A few actually agreed. I was disgusted within an inch of my life, but the troublemaker was calmly tolerated in the hospital. What could anyone do? Surely the hospital office knew who and what he was, yet nothing happened. When I could walk again, I was allowed to go to Berlin. Hardship was obviously very severe everywhere. Millions were suffering from hunger. Discontent was all around. In different shelters where the soldiers visited, and in pubs, the tone was the same as at the hospital. It seemed like these fellows deliberately sought out such spots in order to spread their views. But things were even worse, much worse, in Munich itself. When I was discharged from the hospital after my recovery and was assigned to the reserve battalion, I hardly recognized the city again. Anger, disgust, and abusive talk were everywhere. In the reserve battalion itself, the spirit was absolutely beneath contempt. One factor was the total incompetent treatment of the active soldiers by non-commissioned training officers who had never spent a single hour on the battlefield. For this reason, they were only able to establish a working relationship with the battle-experienced soldiers. The old frontline soldiers did have certain peculiarities, which were the result of their own experience at the front lines, but these were incomprehensible to the inexperienced officers of the reserve troops. An officer who had himself come from the front was not puzzled by them. Such an officer received a very different sort of respect from that given to officers who served at the rear from the action or at headquarters. Besides this, the general temper was awful. Avoidance of military service began to be considered a sign of higher wisdom, while the faithful endurance of service became the earmark of inner weakness and partial blindness. The government offices were full of Jews. Almost every clerk was a Jew, and every Jew a clerk. I was astonished at the multitude of this multitude of chosen people, and could not help comparing it with their sparse presence at the front lines. The situation in business was even worse. Here the Jewish people had actually become indispensable. The spider was slowly beginning to suck the blood from the people. In the business of war companies, an instrument had been found to gradually sweep away the national free economy. The necessity of creating centralized suppliers without restrictions was emphasized. In fact, by 1916 to 1917, almost all production was under the control of financial Jewry. But at whom did the people now direct its hatred? I was horrified to see a doom approach which was bound to lead to a collapse if it wasn't avoided in time. While the Jew was plundering the whole nation and forcing it under his domination, people were being turned against the Prussians. At the front lines and at home, nothing was done by the leadership to curb this poisonous propaganda. Nobody seemed to understand that the collapse of Prussia would not mean the rise of Bavaria. On the contrary, the fall of one would inevitably drag the other with it into the abyss. This behavior caused me infinite pain. I could see no purpose in it, except that it was the Jews' most inspired trick to distract the general attention from themselves to others. While Bavarians and Prussians were quarreling, the Jew was sneaking the income from under their noses. While the Bavarians were damning the Prussians, the Jew organized a revolution, and with one blow shattered both Prussia and Bavaria. I could not stand to watch this doomed feud along the Germans' lands among the German clans, and preferred to return to the front lines. I asked to be transferred there immediately after my arrival in Munich. By the end of March 1917, I was back with my regiment again. Toward the end of 1917, the deepest point of the army's depression seemed to be passed. After the Russian collapse, the whole army had a new hope and courage. The belief that the struggle would end with a German victory now began to grow in the hopes in the troops more and more. Singing was heard again, and there were fewer grumblers. People believed in the future of the fatherland again. The Italian collapse in the autumn of 1917 had a wonderful effect. In this victory, the troops saw proof that it was possible to break through the other fronts beside the Russian campaign. A magnificent faith flooded back into the hearts of millions and made it possible for them to hold out for the spring of 1918 with relieved assurance of victory. The enemy, on the other hand, was visibly miserable. That winter, things were somewhat calmer than usual. It was just the calm before the storm. As the front was making the final preparation to conclude the endless struggle, and as endless lines of transport trains filled with men and supplies were rolling toward the western front, and the troops were being groomed for their great attack, the greatest treachery, the most foul trick of the war, broke out in Germany. Germany must not win the war. At the last moment when the German victory flag threatened to wave, a calculated blow was made to stifle the German spring attack at birth, making victory impossible. The weapons manufacturing strike was organized among the labor unions. If it was successful, the German front would break, and the wish of the social democratic newspaper Vorwärts, or Forward, that Germany would not be the victory this time would be fulfilled. Without weapons, the front would collapse in a few weeks, the offensive would be prevented, the political agreement saved, and the international capital made ruler of Germany. Cheating the people was the inner goal of the Marxists, and they succeeded. It was the destruction of the national economy in order to establish the rule of international capital, and it happened thanks to the stupidity and gullibility of one side and the enormous cowardice of the other. The munitions strike was not as successful as was hoped and did not deprive the front line of weaponry and armaments. It collapsed too early for the weapon shortage alone to condemn the army to destruction according to the plan. However, the moral damage that was done was so much worse. First, what was the army fighting for if people at home did not even want victory? Who were the enormous sacrifices and hardships for? The soldier is sent out and told to fight for victory, and at home they strike against it. Second, what was the effect on the enemy? In the winter of 1917-18, dark clouds rose for the first time on the Allied sky. For almost 4 years, the Allies leaned against the German giant and had been unable to topple him. He had only one arm holding a shield for defense in the west, which left his sword arm free to swing to the east and south. Now, the giant was finally free from his battles behind. Rivers of blood had flowed before he succeeded in smashing one of his adversaries. Now, the giant could turn and let the sword join the shield in the west. The enemy had not succeeded so far in breaking down the defense. The attack would now fall completely on him. The enemy dreaded him and feared the imminent victory. In London and Paris, there was one meeting after another, but on the front line, a drowsy silence reigned. The insolence of the Allied leaders suddenly sank. Even the enemy propaganda was struggling. It was not as easy to prove the impossibility of a German victory. The same thing was also true on the front lines. They, too, began to see a strange light. Their inner attitude toward the German soldier had changed. Up until now, they might have thought he was a fool marked for defeat, but now they were facing the destroyer of their Russian ally. The necessary confinement of German objectives to the east now seemed to be a part of an inspired strategy. For 3 years, the Germans had charged against Russia and appeared to have no effect. People almost laughed at these pointless attempts, which they were. After all, the Russian giant, with his superior numbers, must be the ultimate winner, while Germany would surely collapse from loss of blood. The evidence seemed to justify his hope. Starting in September 1914, when the endless masses of Russian prisoners from the Battle of Tannenberg, a decisive battle between Russia and Germany in the early days of the First World War, began to march into Germany along highways and railroads in long the caravans. The stream appeared to continue forever, but for every Russian army that was beaten and annihilated, a new one rose to take its place. The vast empire kept giving the Tsar new soldiers and fed the war its new victims. How long could Germany last in this race? Wouldn't the day come, after a great German victory, when the Russian army reserves would prepare themselves for the final battle? And then what? In all human probability, Russia's victory might be postponed, but it would eventually come. Now, all these hopes pinned on Russia were lost. The ally who had laid the greatest blood sacrifices on the altar for the Allies was at the end of his strength and lay at the feet of the merciless attacker. Fear and horror crept into the hearts of the soldiers who, up until now, had filled their minds with blind faith. They now feared the coming spring. If they had not succeeded in breaking the German line when he could give only part of his energy to take the Western Front, how could they expect victory against the entire strength of the mighty land of heroes which was gathering itself for an attack? The shadows of defeat from the south Tyrolean mountains, the Alto Adige mountain range in Italy, sank uneasily on the imagination. As far away as the fog of Flanders in France, the beaten armies of General Cadorna created gloomy spirits, and their belief in victory crumbled as they saw a future filled with fear and defeat. General Luigi Cadorna led 250,000 Italian soldiers to their death in the early days of the First World War along the Isonzo River, and he achieved little or no military gains. "It's a me!" Just as people thought they could hear the steady rumble from advancing shock troops of the German army in the cool of night, and when they were anxiously expecting the coming Judgment Day, suddenly a glaring red light blazed from Germany, throwing its flare into the last shell hole of the enemy front. At the moment the German divisions were making their final preparations for the great assault, the great labor union strike broke out in Germany. For a moment the world was speechless. But then, with a sigh of relief, the enemy propaganda grabbed this opportunity for a reprieve in the 12th hour. In one strike, they found ways to restore the diminishing confidence of the Allied soldiers, to call the chance of victory a certainty again, and to change the uneasy dread of what was coming into a confident determination. Now, the regiments waiting for the inevitable German attack could go into the greatest battle of all time with the conviction that the end of the war would be decided not by the bravery of the German assault, but by the persistence of its own defenses. Let the Germans win as many victories as they pleased. At home, the Marxist Revolution was welcomed as it marched in, not the victorious army. The English, French, and American newspapers began to plant this belief in the hearts of their readers, while a substantial and skillful propaganda movement fed the morale of their troops at the front. "Germany on the eve of revolution! Victory of the Allies inevitable!" This was the best medicine to set the wavering French and English on their feet. Now German rifles and machine guns could be fired again, but instead of fleeing in panic and terror, they met determined resistance and confidence. This was the result of the strike at the weapons factories. It strengthened the enemy's faith in victory and swept away the paralyzing hopelessness of the Allied front. Afterward, thousands of German soldiers paid with their lives, while the originators of this dishonorable wickedness were slated to move into the highest state offices of Germany as a result of the revolution. The visible effects of this act on the German troops could be overcome for now, but on the enemy's side, the results had a long-lasting effect. The resistance was no longer an aimless army that had given everything up for lost, but instead the bitter intensity of a struggle for victory appeared. In all human probability, victory would come if the Western Front could just hold out for a few months against the German attack. The parliaments of the Allies recognized this future chance for victory and approved the use of astonishing, stupendous amounts of money to continue the propaganda which would eventually undermine Germany. It was my good fortune to have a part in the first two and the last offensives. They are the most tremendous impressions of my life. They were tremendous because this was the last time the struggle lost the character of defense and took on that of attack, as it felt in 1914. The men in the trenches and dugouts of the Germany army drew a deep sigh of relief now that the day of revenge was here. At last, after more than 3 years of stubbornly resisting the enemy inferno. Once more, the victorious battalion shouted, and they hung the last immortal laurel wreaths on the battle flags amid the lightning flashes of victory. Once more, the songs of the fatherland roared toward heaven along the endless marching columns, and for the last time, the Lord's mercy smiled. In midsummer of 1918, stifling heat covered the front. At home, people were quarreling. Over what? Many stories circulated through the various divisions of the army in the field. The war was now hopeless, they said, and only fools could still believe in victory. The people had no more interest in continuing in resistance. Only the capitalists and the monarchy wanted to continue. That was the story from home, and it was discussed on the front as well. At first, there was scarcely any reaction. What did we care about general voting rights? Was that what we had fought 4 years to gain? It was a piece of evil robbery to steal the war's goal from the graves of dead heroes. The young regiments that died in Flanders did not cry, "Long live general voting rights!" But they shouted, "Germany ahead of all!" The difference was small, but not insignificant. Those who were shouting for general voting rights were never there when the fighting was going on. The whole political party rabble were strangers to the front. One only saw a fraction of the honorable parliamentarians in places where decent Germans were found. The old soldiers, who were the backbone of the front, had no interest in this new war aim of Ebert, Scheidermann, Barth, and Liebknecht, social democrats who were key figures in the German Revolution of 1918. We could not see why these slackers should suddenly have the right to inappropriately claim state authority for themselves over the army's leadership. My personal attitude was settled from the start. I hated the whole pack of wretched nation-swindling party scoundrels intensely. I had realized for a long time that with this gang it was a question of filling their empty pockets and not of the nation's warfare. For this purpose, they were now willing to sacrifice all the people, and if necessary, let Germany go to her doom. In my eyes, it was time to string them up. Giving in to their wishes meant sacrificing the interests of the working people in favor of a set of pickpockets. Those wishes could only be fulfilled if one were ready to give up Germany, and this is what the great majority of the fighting army still thought. The reinforcements from home quickly grew worse and worse. Their arrival weakened instead of strengthened the fighting power. The young reinforcements in particular were mostly worthless. Often, it was hard to believe that these were sons of the same people who had once set out their youth in the Battle of Ypres. I don't know if I'm saying that right. The first battle of Ypres, also called the Battle of Flanders in 1914. Okay, moving on. In August and September, the symptoms of disintegration quickly increased. The enemy attacked with terrible effect, but it was mild when compared to the past defensive battles of Somme and Flanders, battlefields in France, which were blood-curdling. At the end of September, my division retook for the third time places which we had once stormed as young volunteer regiments. Those were some great memories, for there, in October and November of 1914, we had received our baptism of fire. With love of the fatherland in its heart and a song on its lips, our young regiment had gone to battle as if to a dance. The most precious blood was joyfully given in the belief that this would preserve independence and freedom for the fatherland. In July of 1917, we walked on this ground, sacred for all of us, for the second time. Here slept the best of our comrades, children almost, who had given their lives for the fatherland, their eyes glowing with enthusiastic love. We veterans, who had marched out with the regiment long ago, stood with deep reverence at this altar of faithfulness and obedience unto death. The regiment had stormed this ground 3 years before. Now it was to defend it in a bitter battle of resistance. With 3 weeks of continuous artillery, the English prepared for the Great Flanders Offensive. Now the spirits of the dead seemed to come alive. the regiment braced itself in the filthy mud and dug into the shell holes and craters, unyielding, unwavering, and grew smaller and thinner, just as they had once before at this spot. Finally, the English attack came on July 31st, 1917. Early in August, we were relieved by fresh troops. What once had been the regiment was now a few companies. They staggered back, covered with mud, more like ghosts than men. Except for a few hundred yards of shell holes, the Englishmen had only one death. Now, in the fall of 1918, we stood for the third time on the ground we had stormed in 1914, the small town of Comines in Belgium, where we once had been stationed on a base, was now our battlefield. The battleground was the same, only the men had changed. The troops now talked politics, too. The poison from home began to take effect here, as it was everywhere else. The younger reinforcements were absolutely useless because they came from home where they had succumbed to its effects. On the night of October 13th to 14th, the English attacked with gas on the southern front of south of Ypres. They used yellow cross gas. Yellow crosses were painted on gas shells to show they were contaminated mustard gas-producing liquid, whose effect was unknown to us as far as personal experience was concerned. I found out about it firsthand that very night. The evening of October 13th, on a hill south of Werwijk, a Belgian municipality in West Flanders, we were subjected to a pounding of gas bombs lasting several hours, and it continued more or less violently all night. By midnight, half of us were knocked out of action, some of our comrades forever. Toward morning, I was gripped by more and more violent pains as the minutes passed. By 7 o'clock in the morning, my eyes felt like they were on fire. I fumbled and staggered to the rear, taking with me my last messenger report I was destined to deliver in the war. Within a few hours, my eyes had turned to red-hot coals, and everything around me was dark. I was sent to the hospital in the German city of Pazwalk, on the Uecker River, in Pomerania, an area now split between Germany and Poland. And there, I had to experience the greatest disgrace of this country, the Revolution. There had been something vague and repulsive in the air for some time. The gossip was that things were going to pop in the next few weeks. The gossip was that things were going to pop in the next few weeks. I could there have been something vague and repulsive in the air for some time. The gossip was that things were going to pop in the next few weeks. I could not imagine what they meant by things. That's word for word. My first thought was of a strike like the one in spring. Unpleasant rumors were constantly coming from the Navy, which was supposed to be in a state of confusion. To me, this seemed more the creature of a few scattered rascals' brains than any concern of a large mass of people. In the hospital, everyone talked about the ending of the war, which they hoped would be soon, but no one counted on it being immediately. I could not read newspapers because of my eyes. In November, the general tension increased. Then one day, suddenly and unexpectedly, the disaster was upon us. Sailors came in trucks, inspiring and rousing us to join the revolution. A few Jew boys were the leaders in this struggle for the freedom, beauty, and dignity of our national people. None of them had been at the front lines or seen any action. Three Orientals who were sent home from behind the lines by way of the so-called Clap Hospital, that is to say venereal disease, left Marx's flag behind, and these red rags were now hoisted up in the hospital. By that time, my condition had begun to improve somewhat. The pain in the hollows of my eyes lessened, and I could distinguish rough outlines of my surroundings again. I had hopes of getting my eyesight back, at least enough so that I would be able to find some useful occupation. I did not, however, hope to be able to draw again. Still, I was on the road to recovery when another monstrous thing happened. My first hope was that this high treason was only a local affair. I tried to cheer up some of my comrades with that reassurance. My Bavarian hospital mates, in particular, were willing to accept this outlook. Their temper was anything but revolutionary. I could not imagine that the craziness would break out in Munich, because I thought the respect for the house of Wittelsbach, the royal house of the German state of Bavaria, was sure to be stronger there than the will of a few Jews. I could not help but tell myself it was just a matter of a revolt in the navy which could be put down in the next few days. The next few days came, and with them the most horrible information I have received in my life. The rumors grew even more alarming. What I thought was a local matter was a general revolution. On top of it all, the shameful news came from the front. They were going to surrender. How could this be possible? On the 10th of November, the pastor came to the hospital for a short speech, and we found out the whole story. Those around me were extremely excited as we listened to his brief speech. The dignified old gentleman seemed to be trembling like a leaf as he informed us that the House of Hohenzollern, the noble families of Prussia, Germany, and Romania, could no longer wear the crown of the German emperors. The fatherland has become a republic, and our fatherland would certainly be under the control of other people in the future. He said we must beg the Almighty not to withhold his blessing of the transformation and not to forsake our people in the times to come. He could not refrain from saying a few words about the royal house. He tried to speak in appreciation of what it had done for Pomerania, for Prussia, for the German fatherland, and here he began to weep softly. Profound unhappiness came upon every heart in the little hall, and I do not believe there was a dry eye at this point. The old gentleman tried to continue and began to tell us that we would now have to end the long war and that the future of our fatherland would face heavy burdens. The war was lost, and we were throwing ourselves upon the mercy of the victors. He also said the armistice was to be accepted and our trust was put in the generosity of our enemy. By that time, I could stand it no longer. It was impossible for me to stay in the room. Everything went black before my eyes, and I staggered and stumbled my way back to the dormitory, flung myself upon my cot, and buried my burning head in the blanket and pillow. I had not cried since the day I stood beside my mother's grave. In my youth, whenever I was gripped by the hard and cruel hand of fate, my stubbornness increased. When death took dear comrades and friends from our ranks in the long years of the war, I would have thought it almost a sin to complain. Were they dying for Germany or not? When I fell victim to the creeping gas that began to eat into my eyes during the very last days of that frightening struggle, and I suffered the horror of going blind forever, there was a moment when I was ready to lose courage, but then the voice of conscience thundered at me, "You miserable wretch! Who are you to whimper while thousands of souls are 100 times worse off than you?" So I bore my fate in silence. I had realized for the first time how personal suffering disappears in the face of the misfortune of the fatherland. It had all been in vain. All the sacrifices and starvation were in vain. The hunger and thirst that stretched for months without end were in vain. The hours gripped by deathly terror in which we still did our duty were in vain. And the death of the 2 million who gave their lives, it was all in vain. Surely the graves would open up, returning all the hundreds of thousands who had marched out believing in the fatherland? Surely they must open and send forth the silent heroes, covered with mud and blood as avenging spirits, to the homeland which had so outrageously cheated them of the highest sacrifice that a man can offer to his people in this world? Was this what the soldiers of August and September 1914, referring to the Battle of Tannenberg, where the Germans decimated the Russians, had died for? Was this why the volunteer regiments followed their old comrades in the fall of the same year? Was this why the boys of 17 had died on the soil of Flanders? Was this the meaning of the sacrifice that the German mother made for the fatherland when, with an aching heart, she sent her dearest boys out never to see them again? Was all this so a mob of miserable criminals could dare to lay hands on the fatherland? Was this why the German soldier, exhausted by sleepless nights and endless marches, hungry, thirsty, and frozen, had stood fast through burning sun and driving snow? Okay, I'm sorry, I have to interject right now. Hitler has a really nasty tendency to go on and on with unnecessarily exhaustive questions. I can see where Nigel learned it from. And on that point, kudos to you, Nigel, for emulating the Führer, but I'm sorry to say that no, this is bad. Don't keep, do not bludgeon your audience or reader with a point. Once you've made the point, move on from the point. Like, now I'm going to stop and move on. Truly, these heroes deserved a monument that says, "Stranger, when you travel to Germany, tell them that we lay here, faithful to the fatherland and obedient to duty." These words are paraphrased from the monument erected at Thermopylae in Greece to the memory of Leonidas and his Spartan soldiers. But was the supreme sacrifice all we must consider? Was the Germany of the past still worthless? Do we have any obligation to our own history? Were we still worthy enough to take on ourselves the glory of the past, and how could this deed be justified in the future? These are immoral and miserable criminals. The more I tried to understand this outrageous event, the more my cheeks burned with indignation and shame. The pain of my eyes was nothing compared to this wretchedness. Awful days and worse nights followed. I knew that all was lost. Only fools, or these liars and criminals, could hope for the enemy's mercy. During those nights, hatred grew. Hatred for the perpetrators of this deed. In the next days, I became aware of my own fate. I had to laugh when I thought of my personal future, which had caused me so much worry only a short time ago. It was funny to think of building houses on this ground. Finally, I realized that the thing I had dreaded so often, the thing which was inevitable, had happened, but I did not have the heart to believe it. Emperor William II had been the first German emperor to offer the hand of reconciliation to the leaders of Marxism, not dreaming that those crooks have no honor. While they grasped the imperial hand with their left hand, the other was reaching for the sword. With the Jew there can be no understanding or agreement, but only the unyielding either-or. I resolved to become a politician.